As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The race is on, and while we're getting excited about the possibility of the F1 season getting going in early July, albeit without holding our breath, we've got more listener questions to answer on Grand Prix racing, ancient and modern. We've also got an update about the 2021 cost cap and a look at F1's finances amid the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Ed Straw, and my guests with all the answers are Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell. Mark, let's come to you first. I'd like an update on your lockdown antics. As last time I checked, you were watching lots of Can-Am, and you've probably run out of Can-Am now to go through. So have you moved on to anything else?
It didn't run for very long, unfortunately. Not long enough for the duration of this lockdown. Continued bike riding. You know, my daily exercise and a few sort of adventures there. I was going up country roads and just looking at places I'd never been before, and thought I'd discovered this church, but it turned out to be a water tower. It's Lim Water Tower, which is now a private house, and I think it was in Grand Designs once. So I wasted about half an hour trying to work out how to get to this church, and it was just a water tower.
And you got done for trespassing?
No, they didn't see me. Oh, yeah.
You're an accomplished trespasser, obviously. We know who to send if we've got a little bit of snooping to do. How about you, Scott? Any trespassing going on in Stockholm?
Never knowingly trespassed me. So I might well have done. I don't feel like I've ventured far enough to actually come close to trespassing. On the subject of coming across, or well, what people think a church is, I actually not in the last week or so, but like a couple of weeks ago, went for a walk around Stockholm and walked up to this really cool old wooden church. That's about 5-10 minutes walk from my flat. It's one of, if not the oldest, active wooden churches in Stockholm. It's really, really cool old building. And that one definitely is a church, not a water tower.
I was going to say it could be a wooden water tower. It's good to know people are getting their exploring in. That's worth doing. But it's going to be a little bit longer before we're out and about on the F1 trail. We should actually as well, Mark, let you get in your excuses early, because you have warned us that you're close to a voice failure.
Yes, indeed. Yes, it's not at its strongest. So if it goes a bit squeaky, you're warned in advance.
Yeah, well, we're well used to your voice being a little bit odd anyway, so it'll probably just be a different kind of odd. Before we get on to the listener questions, there are a few news items to tackle. Mark, obviously we've got the question of the cost cap. We seem to be close to it being agreed as being $145 million cost cap. That's down from $175. That's the introduction in 2021. So where exactly are we with that?
Yeah, there's a general loose agreement at the moment that they will accept a cost cap of 145, as you say, coming down from the originally planned 175, and that it's got inclusions and, you know, driver salaries, engine manufacturer, etc. That's for 2021. That's yet to be signed off, but it's generally agreed. What's not agreed is where the cap glides down to in 2022. Some teams are pushing for it to go down as low as 100 million. Helmut Marko's campaigning for 130. But Ferrari's not at all happy about going any further below 145. The next stage is the Liberty FIA will come up with a proposal, which we can assume will be some sort of compromise between those positions, and the teams will vote on it. If it gets a majority, the FIA will then incorporate it into the cost cap agreement. But to repeat, it's the 2022 figure that's being argued about. For 21, we look set for 145, which with the exclusion with the exclusions is about 50 million less than Ferrari currently spends. So it's already quite a difficult squeeze if they don't want to make redundancies, and that's their big concern.
Yeah, as always, the question of redundancies is the big one. I think my favourite exclusion in the cost cap is the three highest paid personnel outside of drivers. I always imagine some of the highest paid personnel all agreeing that's a very, very good proposal. So I'm going to suggest a podcast cost cap whereby on this podcast the three highest paid guests, which of course is us three, can be paid as much as we want and everyone else can have very little. I think that's a...
And who pays us?
You haven't been paid.
No, it's not that I haven't been paid. I just wonder who pays this sum that we decide unilaterally we're going to have. We surely need the agreement of whoever's money it is.
No, we can just arbitrarily decide. That's fine.
The last thing you need to do is agree for the people who are paying. You demand. That's how
you
do things.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'll be right behind you, Ed.
excellent. Well, Scott, there's also the Liberty Media did their F1 first quarter financial results back end of last week. So you've got a bit of an idea of how much damage the pandemic has done. So can you put that a little bit into context and where F1 is?
Yeah, we knew that it wasn't going to be good news, obviously, but I still think seeing it in black and white and the extent of the numbers was still quite striking. So whichever way you want to cut the numbers, it's a massive loss. It's total revenue for Q1 compared to 2019 is down more than $200 million. That equates to 84% in total reduction. The primary revenue, which is broadcasting payments and hosting fees and sponsorship of races, is down, I think, more than 90%. So it's obviously a colossal loss. If you wanted to try and look at it from an optimist perspective, you could say that a business that has done no business in the first 3 months of 2020 has still produced $39 million in revenue. But I think that's a slightly optimistic way of looking at it. It's only going to get worse in Q2 because the Q1 only included Australia and Bahrain. So the other eight races, I think it is, that have been postponed or cancelled, those eight races fall within Q2, so the numbers are going to be really, really stark when they come out, which will probably, I think that'll be trying to do basic mathematics in my head, that'll be at the start of July. So the damage is significant, but to put it into context, Liberty hasn't included the money that they would have received from Australia and Bahrain because those races didn't go ahead. They haven't included as well the payments that have been made to teams, because the way they do that within their accounting practices, they do that on a pro rata basis. So because those races haven't technically happened, those payments don't exist in Liberty's accounting world, and it'll all be sorted out further down the line. So the numbers are what Liberty has reported rather than 100% depiction of reality. It is obviously very bad, but it should also be pointed out that F1 is very confident that it can come through this, even in the worst case scenario that there is no racing in 2020, because a couple of weeks ago now, Liberty Media did this very complex reattribution within the group that shifted a bunch of debt and assets away from Formula One onto a different side of the Liberty business, and gave the F1 side of Liberty more than $1 billion in cash, basically, to play around with. So they have an emergency fund. They're not going to be handing out candy, as Chase Carey said, to teams or partners or whatever, but there is now they're in a position to shore up their own finances, whatever happens, and if worst case scenario develops, maybe they can help teams out as well.
All things considered, Mark, it seems that the F1 and Liberty as a whole have done a reasonable job in reacting to the wider situation, doesn't it? It's never easy, but moves have been taken. They're not just sticking their head in the sand and assuming everything will work out once the world starts turning again.
No, they've been very proactive. They're anticipating the pain it's going to be causing to the teams, and they've got themselves, as Scott was saying, a whole bunch of liquidity to help them get over that, what's hopefully going to be a one-season hump. May go on longer than that, but I think that Liberty's generally, Liberty's pockets are deep enough to get us through with out the other side with everybody in terms of the teams still in shape, to compete. And I think yes, they've done absolutely as much as been humanly possible on that.
And as part of that, obviously, the determination to get the season up and running as quickly as possible with the hope of running in Austria with the biosphere races, they're calling it, with teams not allowed to mingle and just testing every 2 days, all these things. So they're doing what they can to get up and running as soon as possible. Well, let's move on to our listener questions now. We'll rotate between us. So this one's coming to you first, Scott. This is from Bernhard, just Bernhard, via Twitter. Does there need to be an asterisk against the winner of the 2020 season? Would it in any way blemish Lewis Hamilton's achievement should he equal Schumacher's record?
I think the easy answer is no, because F1 seasons have been at various lengths since the inception of the World Championship in 1950, and we don't put an asterisk against the winner of any of the early seasons, do we? So I think it would obviously be looked on as an exceptional season, but there are challenges that go into winning a reduced 2020 season that don't exist in other years. You know, it's going to be, if Lewis ends up winning the 2020 title and equals Schumacher's record, he'll have done it with what must go down as the longest break between races in F1 history, at least certainly in recent history. And he's had to overcome months out of the car. He's responded to an extraordinary scenario best and better than any of his rivals. It will be a test, because it will mean that Mercedes and Hamilton didn't let anything slip in a short number of races. There's going to be more pressure than ever to maximize the races available. So I don't think it comes with an asterisk in a negative sense. The only asterisk you'd apply to it is you would just look on that as, when Hamilton won this title, it was done in utterly extraordinary circumstances. But I don't think that's a bad thing.
It'd be the same for whoever wins it, whether if it's Max Verstappen, Charles Leclerc, Sebastian Vettel, whoever. I think the number of races doesn't really impact it. Every championship's got its own character, hasn't it, and the way it goes. And it may be that because of the way the season goes, something strange happens, and you could say, well, actually the best driver didn't win, but that's the same with any season, I'd say. Well, Mark, question for you. Scott sort of touched on this very briefly about the long gap. This is not just Andrew on Twitter. Asks, will, when F1 returns in a couple of months' time, the teams and drivers need a 2 or 3 day pre-season test just to get drivers and staff operationally ready for the season? So you're the perfect person for this, because you wrote a piece on the race's website at therace.com, and don't forget the hyphen, about this exact challenge recently.
Yeah, I talked to the driver trainer, Dr. Ceccarelli, about the mental effects of the layoff, particularly in lockdown, and he makes some fascinating points. Essentially, there are many potential hazards in mental preparation in this period, and how well each driver has combated them will be important, and there's likely to be some differences there up and down the field. In terms of would they get a pre-season test, it might be something they'd like, but in reality, it's not likely to happen that way. Assuming we state a plan with the first lockdown races in Austria, with the quarantine and the virus testing arrangements, there's not going to be time. It's going to be straight into the program. But it'll be interesting to see if there are any drivers that might be a little rusty, and see how that plays out.
Yeah, and of course, even if they do want to do testing, etc., it's going to be difficult to work out how to do it, because they're going to great lengths, if Austria happens, to create a clean environment, this biosphere. So even running, unless you do it at the track ahead of it, it's difficult to work out how best to do that. Tough challenge, isn't it, Scott?
Yeah, I think it is. We've had a few drivers now that have talked about how rusty people will be when the season starts. George Russell seems particularly optimistic that there'll be some opportunities. Kevin Magnussen, sort of maybe on the more pragmatic side of things, has pointed out that he had nearly an entire season out of a car. What would that have been, in 2015, between his McLaren stint and return with Renault, and said that after halfway through the first day of winter testing, it felt like he'd just had a normal winter out of the car. So it comes back very quickly, and if the teams can get down to lots of mileage, we'll probably have the busiest Friday we've ever had in the history of the World Championship. But I think it will be fascinating to see how they cope, and ultimately the best drivers will prevail. And in the greatest segue in the history of this podcast, speaking of the best drivers, Ed, next question's for you. Who do you think were the best F1 drivers never to win a race? That's from Patrick Down, and he clarifies, I'm thinking those who had a career of some length but who never got in a decent car, rather than those killed or injured before their time.
Well, the go-to answer on the best never to win is normally Chris Amon, and for good reason. He did win non-championship races, 1970 International Trophy, for example, but we're really talking about World Championship races here, which he never did. He got incredibly close. 68 probably is the classic season for him for Ferrari. He had four pole positions, various problems when the Ferrari machinery didn't let him down. A rock hit his radiator, so cost him victory at Spa. He's also a driver who probably cost himself victory by ripping off his own visor accidentally at Monza in 71. That was the race that was famously won by Peter Gethin in that close finish. He tried to remove a tear off but damaged his visor and ended up finishing sixth. It's pretty amazing you can get five poles and lead seven races without managing to win one, but Amon managed it. And there was one caveat in that question about never getting into a top car, but although Amon did drive for Ferrari, it wasn't at a classic time for Ferrari. He also drove for Matra, and of course Matra won the championship with a Tyrrell run car with Jackie Stewart, but the Works Matra team wasn't quite as good. So I'd argue he never quite got into great machinery. But there's a whole litany of drivers. Jean-Pierre Jarier is another one. There are a few races he should have won in the shadow when he started from pole and was in the lead towards the end of the race. In 1975 is the obvious one, and of course he'd had another race just before that when he made a start on pole in Argentina but had a crown wheel failure. So there's a driver who should have won. Mark, any drivers you want to throw into the mix? There's quite a long list, really, aren't there?
Yeah, a few, and I think I'd concur with you on him on it. That's just a statistical freak, really. I mean, in terms of the stature, how good the drivers were that have never won a Grand Prix, he, for me, stands head and shoulders above the others. He's worthy of comparison to some of the greats in terms of virtuoso performances that he's put in. You know, he's been leading races by a minute, against Jackie Stewart and people like that. So one of the greats, and for me, he would be head and shoulders, but I think that's not quite the gist of the question. So in terms of those guys that didn't that had a long career but didn't quite get into a good car, Jarier definitely, probably the fastest driver of the second group, I would say. But as an all-round package, he had some limitations, let's say. I'd put into that mix Bernd Schneider, Pierluigi Martini, Sergio Perez.
Martini's a very, very good call, actually. I think he's very underrated.
I'd put Martin Brundle in there as well. Had he not hurt his foot in his first season, I suspect that he'd not even have been on this list and would have won Grand Prix. But his form up to that point was pretty sensational, and the momentum he had coming off that F3 season where he went head-to-head with Senna was just as quick when they tested the McLaren until Senna got another run with a more powerful engine. He was pretty much as quick as Stefan Belafezi's teammate, who was a sensational talent himself. Points on his debut. So he looked fantastic, but then suffered that awful foot injury. It's sort of similar to Johnny Herbert, although Johnny won races anyway, so he's outside the scope of this question. But Martini had a fantastic record against his teammates, but he alternated between Minardis and Dallaras and things like that, so it wasn't ever in a top team. But as an all-round package, I suspect it might be Schneider.
Yeah, Schneider's quite an interesting call, I would say, because sometimes you get drivers who could or would on their day have won them had things gone slightly differently. But Schneider, yeah, was never in a remotely good car, really, in Formula One, but had a few years that it's a good one. Anyone you want to throw in, Scott?
I think if you're looking at, just to throw a couple of the sort of more recent names into the mix, I think Nico Hülkenberg's never even had a podium, which is just crazy. And I think if you'd have said during Hülkenberg's meteoric rise through the ranks that he would never get a podium, let alone win a race in Formula One, that would have seemed crazy given the success that he had. I think sort of looking a little bit further back, I think someone like Derek Warwick, who, for me, when I was younger and first sort of exposed to wider motorsport, I have to admit, I'm pretty sure I've said this to Derek as well, I had a completely different impression of Derek's caliber as a racing driver, because my first experience, or well, my only experience of him as a racing driver when I was younger, was him in the BTCC. In the Alfa Romeo's sophomore season in Super Touring in the UK, which was an unmitigated disaster, and then obviously his spell with in the Vectras as well. So just that uncompetitive machinery, the BTCC, for someone who didn't know his F1 pedigree, made him look like an ex F1 driver of poor reputation and quality. So. To then, as I got older and then discovered just how good he was, and how I find it quite ridiculous that he never won races. Obviously he had the Renault stint in a fast but fragile car, and then obviously his career took a different direction thanks to the assistance of one Ayrton Senna as well. So I think Warwick's quite high on the list as well.
Yeah, there's a huge list of drivers who probably could have won races given the right opportunity. For the most part, the kind of extraordinary talents normally find their way, but doesn't always. You don't always get the career you deserve. Scott, next question for you. Joe Dearsley asks, how realistic is a return to San Marino or a race at the Portimao circuit? Promoters have been bullish about their ability to host a race. So Imola or Algarve, do you think they're a threat to hold a Grand Prix this year?
I think they're not as likely as Hockenheim, shall we say. And we know from the call that Chase Carey was on discussing the Q1 results for Liberty Media last week. Chase admitted for the first time that there are discussions with tracks, plural, that weren't on the original 2020 schedule. And this is because F1 is obviously not scrambling as such, but is trying to work out what kind of schedule it can put together in Europe to have races that don't need to host fans. And obviously that completely changes the dynamic of discussions. It opens up the door to venues that would otherwise be unrealistic hopefuls for a Grand Prix, because it's the cost of holding a race, the race hosting fee that F1 commands, that puts a lot of these circuits out of business. It's why Germany fell off the calendar and was rescued for 2019, but is back off it again for 2020. So all of a sudden, you've seen a bunch of circuits come out of the woodwork. Imola is one that for the last 12 months, I think, has been constantly sort of chancing its arm and saying, well, hey, come on, we're here. We'd be up for it. We can't give you any money, but hey, let's have a Grand Prix here. Algarve has, I think, fairly recently, hasn't it, been upgraded, and it now satisfies the necessary FIA specifications, and they're getting really bullish about the prospects of something behind closed doors. They say that they've held trials and that they could be an option to F1 or MotoGP, but I think that Hockenheim is the best option. I think that's probably the most serious, because it's a circuit that was hosting F1 races until last year. It knows what's needed, and F1 knows what it gets from it. Most importantly, it knows that it's got the capacity and the experience to pull it off. So I'd be surprised if Algarve or Imola suddenly cropped up on a revised schedule, but I wouldn't be as surprised if something like Hockenheim suddenly re-emerged.
There's a connected question to this, which I'll throw to you, Mark, which is from Phil Wright, saying F1's been on a ruthless drive to find new circuits in recent years, and they've lost some more historic circuits. But with the current COVID situation, has the balance shifted with some of these older circuits, the European tracks that have been left behind? Is F1 now reliant on those to be able to put together a championship?
The balance has shifted between Formula One itself and the circuits that it's in discussion with, it compared to how it was before the virus, because obviously F1's now desperate, the whole race is supposed to get the TV rights income, which in essence feeds the teams, but they can't charge a hosting fee, obviously, when races are behind closed doors. The circuits have no way of making money from the ticket sales. So, yeah, in the negotiating with Liberty, the circuits are in a position to strike a deal that works for them, deals that have nothing to do with the original race hosting deals. But returning to the point about the other older circuits, it's not when Formula One's not really, at the moment, things stand, scrabbling about looking for venues. It's more if we start in July at Austria and follow on with Silverstone and Hungary, after that there's a little gap where we can slot some more races in, which much more likely to be a Hockenheim or a Barcelona than a long ago circuit, you know. So after that, the hopeful plan is this latter part of the season will continue as originally scheduled, you know, with some tweaks obviously, but generally a shape that looks quite familiar. So I don't think the big limitation is finding suitable venues. So the ones that are in discussion, yes, the balance has changed, but I don't think the old circuits are in really a particularly strong position.
Yeah, especially considering Europe isn't exactly in a great situation at the moment, pandemic-wise as well, is it? So would you agree with all that, Scott?
Yeah, definitely. Carey's said that they're getting increasingly confident now with the number of venues and races that are not only willing to host the race but actually able to as well, because obviously as Mark says, F1 is never has any shortage of suitors. It's just whether or not those suitors are suitable. So I think it just comes down to the logistics of making it work. And I agree with Mark. I don't foresee an utterly unexpected old race coming from absolutely nowhere. I'll throw the next question to you, Ed. It's from our video editor extraordinaire, Luke Hinsel, who is not allowed on the podcast himself, but we can at least include his question, his terrible, terrible question. He asks, if you're a new team boss for 2021 with a hypothetical new entry, which two out-of-contract drivers are you signing? I mean, if you're putting together a new team for 2021 now, in May 2020, first of all, you've got more money than sense. And second of all, I think you've got bigger issues to overcome than your out-of-contract drivers. But let's humour Luke. What's your answer?
Well, by out-of-contract, I'm going to restrict it to those who might be feasibly interested, because I'm not sure Lewis Hamilton or Daniel Ricciardo would be very keen on Straw F1.
Zero ambition.
But setting aside all non-racing considerations, so not worrying about budget, sponsorship, etc., you definitely need someone with a good amount of F1 experience. So I think probably Nico Hülkenberg. He's still a current driver, quick, still young and motivated enough to give it his all with something to prove. And while his F1 career hasn't gone quite as hoped, and I don't think he's always done the absolute maximum to extract the massive ability that is there, we have also seen a lot of very, very impressive performances from him. The second one's a bit tricky, because my kind of natural inclination is to have a high quality young driver, that's bringing a rookie, but I'd also want them to be someone I can sign up fully to be under contract to my team and not sort of on loan from anyone else, which is quite tricky with the amount of teams that have got young driver schemes. I'd probably have a look at someone like Robert Schwartzman, who's due to race in F2 with Prema this year, but he's a little bit tricky because obviously with that season being delayed, he won't have a kind of normal F2 season to go through before that. And of course, he is already under contract with another big team. So I might, as a new team, be looking for experience. There's part of me that's quite tempted to go a little bit left field, actually,
and bring in another driver with experience, but he's been out of F1, certainly racing in F1 for a while, and that's Paul
Pedro De La Rosa.
I'll tell you what, Pedro would probably be interested in it. He's a good driver in his time, Pedro. Probably still do a decent job. But yeah, Paul De Resta, which I know is a slightly odd suggestion, and people will raise their eyebrows, but a very, very good driver. He was bumped off the grid at a point where more teams needed money, ultimately. I think other than the last half season where things got away from him a little bit with Force India, I think he's a high-quality driver. And he showed when he dropped into the Williams a few years ago in Hungary that he can still do a decent job. So maybe for a first year, I might go with that experience lineup. But I'd also be kind of looking around to see who might drop off the merry-go-round, as it were. But I think even so, even if I had two experienced drivers, I'd definitely be looking at the next young driver to bring on, because I do like having a high-quality sort of rookie driver to come in and develop and either make the most of as the team rises or sell on to a bigger team at a vast profit. That's the Eddie Jordan model. Anyone you'd go for, Scott?
Well, I find it amazing that you didn't even consider Fernando Alonso. I was of the impression that Fernando is so desperate to get back into F1, and surely he'd accept at least a conversation with Straw F1. But fair enough.
I think this would be another. This again is the same as Hamilton or Ricciardo. I don't really think a brand new team like this with necessary modest expectations would benefit from having a driver of that extraordinary level. It's just about picking the best driver for the situation. But you never know. You know, he'd be an interesting one commercially, and perhaps we could have a discussion. Perhaps he could be a part. Perhaps he could come in as an equity partner of the team as well. There's possibilities there now. I mean, there's no question how good Alonso is.
There have been more ridiculous attempts to get drivers into teams and to launch teams than consider a partnership with Fernando. I think.
Could you be hinting at Jacques Villeneuve?
I think Hülkenberg's actually Villeneuve probably fancies his chances at this, doesn't he? I think Hülkenberg is a good shout, but I think his concern would be, I don't think he would do what, let's say, a Romain Grosjean did and take a punt on a new team, because Hülkenberg, I think, would only, his suggestion is he'd only come back to F1 with a team that he feels is capable of producing a weapon that can fight for points. And I'm not trying to disparage the intentions of Straw F1, but I think you might struggle to do that outside of the box. I would move heaven and earth to get like a proper Mercedes engine deal, and then see if I can try and prize one of their drivers. You never know whether or not you could have a situation where that someone like Kovalainen was in, when you lose a big team drive, and all of a sudden you're tumbling right down to the other end of the grid. So if they decided to flick Valtteri Bottas, for example, maybe you could sneak in Bottas, but I'm not really sure. I mean, I think it is difficult, because you just never really know exactly how much you can sell your team to these drivers. But I think if you're looking at, let's say for argument's sake, you can tempt drivers, your ambitions aren't a problem. I think a combination of, say, a Hülkenberg and a Guan Yu Zhu or something like that, because Zhu is someone who's going to bring a lot of money to your team. It's whether or not you can prize him from his Renault link. So yeah, I like that. I like that mix of experience and youth. It would just depend how credible your team is as an entry.
Oh, it'd be very credible, I'm sure. any names you throw in there, Mark, or have we covered everyone
well,
in the world?
Yeah, I mean, just to change the context, the question a little bit. Let's assume it's not a struggling low budget, low rent entity like Straw F1. Let's pretend it's a mega manufacturer team with the unlimited budget. I don't know. It's Porsche backed by the VW Group, and it's paid off all its diesel fines and everything. Yeah, I'd put Hamilton Alonso back together again. You know, I like a challenge. If I couldn't get one of those two, it'd be Daniel Ricciardo. If I couldn't get any of them, then I'd go for Vettel. But yeah, why not? You aim high.
Yeah, well, if you got the money behind it and the name behind it, that's well worth going for. Scott, moving on. Mike 8498 on Twitter, I'm not sure whether that's his real surname, but he asks, how many DAS systems do you think we'll see at the first race?
I don't doubt that that's his surname, because as we've seen recently with from Elon Musk, there are some quite strange numerical and letter combination names going around now. So it could be. I think I'm going to keep this answer really short. I think there will be one, and it will be on the Mercedes, and I don't even know if it will be used, because teams haven't been able to develop these sorts of systems because of the shutdowns that they've been observing. So it's not like people have been working at the factory improving their cars. It's going to be banned for next year anyway. So I think this situation has completely eradicated the possibility of the DAS being spawned elsewhere. And because of the controversy over it and the threat of a Red Bull protest in Australia, I'm not entirely convinced that Mercedes will use it, even if they, I would imagine it will still be on the car. I'm not suggesting they'll overhaul it, but maybe it'll be there and it will just never be used in an official session.
I'm inclined to agree with that. Would you say the same, Mark?
Yes, for all those reasons. But yeah, it's mainly the shutdown and the very short length of time between the end of shutdown and the first race.
Well, we can move on to your next question now, Mark, which is from Danny Hoare. In your opinion, what season stands out in which a driver outperformed his car the most? Schumacher 96 with Ferrari and Senna 93 with McLaren spring to mind initially.
Schumacher 95, I'd say even more than 96, actually. The Benetton wasn't as good a car that year as the Williams, unlike the year before. And there were no questions over its legality this time, yet Schumacher dominated. Then when he got to try the 95 Ferrari at the end of the season, of course, when he switched teams, and he couldn't believe how good that was. He said he'd have won the 95 title much easier in that Ferrari than in his Benetton. He much preferred that car to the 96 Ferrari, incidentally. Senna 93, not so much. I think the highs were incredibly high, maybe even higher than even he ever flew. I'm thinking of Donington in particular. But there were also a few races where he didn't really perform that well, or he wasted energy on pointlessly screwing Alan Prost around. Schumacher 95 for me, I would say. That would be the season I'd nominate.
Yeah, that's fair. Any seasons springing to mind for you, Scott?
And it went away. It went a little bit weirdly at the end, but obviously in the modern era, Alonso in 2012 stands out as a particularly good season, aided by the randomness early on, but then obviously fell away, especially those two. What was it? Was it Belgium and Japan? The two first lap, first corner problems that really derailed that bid. But that feels to me like the only real one in recent memory of someone being able to outperform their car, so to speak, to actually launch a title bid. Am I doing anyone a disservice from the noughties? I don't think I am.
No, it's pretty rare because, you
know, by definition.
Well, it is quite rare by definition because in order to outperform your car, you're also relying on others underperforming, should we say.
Yeah.
Because you can only get 100% out of your car, so you're reliant on people in better cars getting less than 100% or less close to 100% out of it. So it's very, 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 very difficult.
Yeah, I know, I agree. I tell you, someone who doesn't have that problem is obviously Lewis Hamilton. And then another example of a superb transition from one question to another, Steve on Twitter, Ed, asks, is Lewis Hamilton unfortunate in that he makes his victories often look easy, which often results in them being met with underwhelming recognition?
Well, it's not a problem unique to Lewis Hamilton. I think any driver who takes a dominant win tends to be regarded as having a pretty easy job by many. And to be fair, there are occasions when it can be pretty straightforward. But the genius of the truly great drivers, they put themselves in the position to look that comfortable time and time again. How often have we seen a quick driver with a good CV get in a top car and struggle to make the most of it? So this shows how accomplished these sorts of drivers are. I mean, we'd all love to see people pulling passes at the last corner to win while on three wheels, having come back from two laps down. But that's just not something that happens. And yeah, the all-time greats, they make the brilliant look mundane. But it's when you dig into that detail, you see the real artistry. It's a bit reductive when people talk about the car doing all the work, because the car, combined with the laws of physics, defines the overall potential. But it's the driver's job to get as close as 100% out of that as possible, not just on one lap, but over every lap in a race, and then over every race weekend, over a season. And that's just the reality of it. I would say that, you know, some dominant victories are easier than others, though. It always makes me think, every now and again, you see on social media that old Fry and Laurie sketch, turns up when you've got Stephen Fry interviewing Hugh Laurie, and Hugh Laurie's a driver who's just won a Grand Prix, and to every positive question he just answers with, oh, it's very difficult, it was very hard, and just this incredulity from Stephen Fry, who which leads to him punching him at the end. And actually, as an aside, he actually did accidentally punch Hugh Laurie in that for extra realism. He didn't intend to do it, but I've digressed there. But yeah, the greats do make it look very, very easy. That's just the nature of it. But that doesn't mean it is, because if it was that easy, then anyone could be a great. And if you look back over the history of Grand Prix racing, there's not that many you'd put into the all-time great bucket.
Yeah, and I think it sort of ties into, it's a slightly different point, but one of the things I think that sometimes gets misinterpreted in the modern day is that traditionally we align great car control with a really delicate slide through the corners, or I'm thinking some of the images from history, like Ronnie Peterson through Woodcote is one of the famous ones, isn't it? And that's sort of seen as this great image of car control. But in the modern age, especially with more and more downforce, car control is all about preventing that. So people think that these cars look really easy and really easy to drive, and they have different challenges to cars of yesteryear, but the car control is in preventing that from happening, which is why you see dabs of Oppo a little bit less. Going back to the original question, because I just wanted to do a follow-up for Mark, which is, do you reckon Lewis sort of do you reckon people sort of look down on Lewis or doubt how hard he's working, because we often hear him complaining about tires and stuff like this over the radio? And do you think that people have just sort of stopped believing him when he says that something's difficult, or that he can't do something with the tires or something like that?
Yeah, I think sometimes they're interpreted, those comments are interpreted the wrong way by the fans. All he's doing is maximizing his chances and trying to prevent anything that's threatening his victory from creeping up on him, such as either the tires are degrading or what have you. And it's a two-way communication with his race engineer that you're hearing. Winning a race is never easy in absolute terms, but obviously some are easier than others. But it's Hamilton's amazing ability that's ensured he's had the pick of the teams, and logically from the start of the hybrid era anyway, there's been no question where the best place to be is. So there's this underwhelming recognition that the question concerns, it's from the outside. It may be just exhaustion of the lack of change in the results, but it's certainly not a widely held view inside. He's held in awe from inside, not just his own team, but throughout the paddock from other teams as well.
I think sometimes there's a bit of a tendency to almost kind of for people to belittle what it takes to win a Grand Prix. You do see that with a lot of sports, actually, people just thinking that because they play football for their pub team or whatever to a high standard for that, they just don't see the differences just because someone might drive their car to the shop, so they think it looks easy. But if you want to get an idea of how hard it is to win, say, a Monaco Grand Prix while tire managing, why don't you take a leaf out of the Nelson Piquet book with his description of Monaco being like riding a bicycle around your apartment. So get your bike, ride round and round your house as fast as you possibly can while you've got, say, a slow puncher or something, and let's see how long it is before you crash. So it is phenomenally difficult to do what these drivers do, and even the worst Grand Prix driver on the grid currently is still outstanding by any measure. Scott, moving on to you, this is a question from Mark's friend Sam, who I call Chris, as we established on the last podcast. This is a question about format, saying what's not to like about having a qualifying session on Saturday morning with half points, a reverse grid sprint race Saturday that gives a point for each place recovered from the reverse grid, then the result forms a grid for Sunday's race, and then you offer proper incentives for qualifying, overtaking, and the main race. Fans would benefit, but the best would still prevail. How do you like that proposal?
I like the element of points for qualifying, because that fits in with a format that I'm a massive fan of, but I'll get to that in a second. A reverse grid race that gives a point for each place recovered from grid position, that's slightly trickier to determine, because in that scenario, do you have points for finishing positions and points for places gained? Otherwise, if you start from pole and win, you don't score any points for it. Although you do get pole for Sunday's race. If you do give points for places gained and end result, there are going to be exceptional scenarios where people start at the back and finish high up and therefore get way more points from this weird race on Saturday than they do for the main event on Sunday. So there's a bit of an issue there. But in general, I like this idea of rewarding qualifying with points, reversing the grid, and then trying to mix things up. So I don't think F1 should ever have to go down this route if the changes for 21 and now obviously 22 of the technical regulations have their desired effect, because while I've got no issue with changing some, like creating some variables, I feel like that is only something that needs to be done if the sport itself is, if the sport itself is in a position where it can't create that naturally. So if you end up with a set of circumstances that guarantee boring races and you just fundamentally cannot change the circumstances that those races are taking place within in terms of the design of the cars and circuits and how easy it is or isn't to overtake, if you exhaust all options, all credible options, and you can't do that, then I don't see any reason why you can't artificially change stuff. My favoured format for this has always been the idea of qualify for points, and it's points from first all the way down to you can cut it off at 15th, or you can do points for everybody to give them an incentive to go out and set the fastest time. And then you have a reversed championship order grid for the Grand Prix itself, because then you have an element of the weekend where these cars are absolutely on the limit, which is what qualifying is. And so there is always going to be this utter pure spectacle, and there's going to be a reward for it as well. So there's no reason for a team to shun going out, risk damaging the car or something like this. So you protect that. But then the race on Sunday itself is fundamentally more entertaining because you've got the fastest car starting at the back rather than giving them a head start. So that's always been my favoured way of artificially spicing things up. But I still retain some optimism we won't need to go down that route, because if everything works as expected and promised, we won't need to, because everything will be slightly better anyway.
I don't like points for qualifying. I'm very happy to have modified formats being looked at and considered as long as it's for good reasons. But I like the points to be awarded purely for the race, that which does mean if you're going to have a reverse grid type thing, qualifying is rendered pointless and therefore doesn't happen, if you see what I mean. But I think it's quite important for the focus and the following of the sport and the prestige of the Grand Prix itself to ensure that it's the race that pays the points. But I'm not anti evaluating all sorts of formats. What about you, Mark? Are you open to this sort of thing?
Yeah, open, but I'm cautious. There's probably a balance to be struck between the history and the DNA and the entertainment value for the casual fan. So I think you might be able to come up with something on the Friday or Saturday that would like a shorter, sharper race that you might be able to encompass. But I would, like Scott, I'd be reluctant to see the end of absolute all-out, flat-out qualifying, because that's when you discover the purity of the performance order. So, I think there's probably something that can be done, but I wouldn't go as far as Sam.
All I would add, which is just really to combat your major concern with it, Ed, which I do share completely. This is a Grand Prix World Championship, and therefore the majority of the work should be done in the Grand Prix itself. But in that situation, I don't see my solution would be that you do award points for qualifying, but you award more points for the race, so you can't score. Whether that means you massively inflate the points available on a Sunday, for example, or however you find a way to make it work, I think there is an avenue to go down there that enshrines that on the limit element of qualifying, means that it isn't futile, but doesn't take away from the ultimate value of the race on Sunday. But I think it would be murdering a few sacred cows, and we know that Formula One's not very good at that. So,
yeah, there's a a real like of the maintaining the tradition, should we say. And some stuff is important to keep, but also tradition can be used as a defense for changing nothing all the time. So it's never a great thing. Mark, question for you now. The perfect question for a fundamentally audio-only, non-visual medium. This is from Carla George, but I'm going to make life difficult for you by putting it to you. Saying, what do you think cars would look like in F1 now if there were no regulations? So total freedom of design, like it was back when it first started. So, yeah, I guess roll back many decades of ever-restricted rules and lay it out, Mark.
Yeah, it's a good question, actually, because if you look at, say, a Maserati 250F from the 50s, and then fast forward 20 years to, I don't know, the Lotus 72 or something, they're from completely different ages. It's very visually obvious. Whereas if you rewind 20 years back from now, the cars don't look that different to the casual eye. You'd need to be looking at the details of the aero surfaces and stuff like that. But to the casual observer, pretty much the same. And that is just a function of regulation. It's limited to where you can find the advantage. So if there were no regulation, I think they'd look a lot like the virtual reality Red Bull X1 of a few years ago. Absolutely gorgeous thing, sort of fighter aircraft type of look. Ground effect fan car, 1,500 horsepower, and it was... They simulated its likely performance and put it around a current circuit, and it was something like, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds faster around Suzuka than a current car. And absolutely beautiful. But it would be pretty much impossible to race other cars. The braking distances would be so small. There would be very, very bad race, and it would just be a lot of beautiful cars flying past one one after the other. It wouldn't actually be racing. Unfortunately, the technology got too advanced to make free regulations possible, really. That's just the way it went.
Yeah, and it would be difficult for the driver as well. You'd have all sorts of measures have to take for them to be able to absorb higher G-forces than would normally be experienced. So it'd be a fun experiment if someone would actually make one of these cars, though, wouldn't it? Just to see what would happen.
Yeah, there was a little bit of a spell of because Ferrari did one, didn't they? They did a simulation of how F1 car of the future could look, and I think there was the Red Bull, there was a Ferrari, I think there may have been a Mercedes as well. They're all absolutely beautiful, and it's all how you would have imagined F1 cars would look by now. If you were just a casual observer, it absolutely nailed that look. But, it wouldn't have been feasible. It wouldn't have been practical.
Scott, am I safe to relinquish control to let you bring Scott's people to the table? Have you done Scott's people this week?
Technically I haven't, but it's because I had so many responses to the question we posed on the previous podcast. And I just felt it was unfair to ignore a bunch of other very valid and good answers to that question, because the question that was posed was if you could watch one race back from history, not just in F1, any race of your choice, with someone in lockdown, what would it be? And if you give me a why, that was also beneficial. We discussed it, the three of us, didn't we, at the end of the last podcast? I think, Mark, you picked Mario Andretti, didn't you?
Indy 81, yeah.
And Ed, what did you pick? I've forgotten what you picked.
Well, I caused problems by invoking...
Did you misunderstand the laws?
No, not really, but I caused problems by invoking the need for a time machine.
Because
I went for the 1935 German Grand Prix, Tezio Nivolari's famous victory in the Alpha at the Nürburgring.
But you need a time machine for any of these things. They're all in the past. It's just a question of how far you go in the time machine, surely.
Well, they are, but for example, in your case, it would be feasible to put you in a room with a television, the full footage of the Indy 500 and Mario Andretti. That's possible.
I see what you mean. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But in fairness, one of the answers we included from Scott's people last time was someone wanting to watch back Monaco with Jules Bianchi. So this is a this is a realm of countless possibilities, and the boundaries of science and reality don't apply. That's the beauty of Scott's People Ed.
I'd like to watch the recent Baku R Factor race of yours, Scott.
No, never. No, we're not discussing that.
I'd like to watch a future race.
Yeah,
that's very good.
I don't know what. I don't know how it pans out.
You would make an absolute killing off that. You could come back and create Mark's Sports Almanac, and then you'd be absolutely sorted.
As long as it's the same universe, not a parallel one.
Yeah, otherwise you're going to look like an idiot.
You're creating a lot of trouble with time travel here, Scott.
No, I know. I'm going to get on with this. I'm going for everything. We've got like another half a dozen ones here. There's a nice little mix of F1 and non-F1. Colm Lawless, who I used to work with in Formula E, who was the social media guru at Formula E a few years ago, picks Sebastian Vettel and Monza 08, which would obviously be quite good. There's actually quite a few races that I think watching back with Seb would be interesting. You know, to pick up on what you said about, you know, if it's just you, the driver, in a room, on TV, full race replay, I think Seb would be really good at picking out some ones. Istanbul, the Clash of War, was that 2010? Yeah, that would be a very good one. Spencer Murphy picked my one from the end of the last podcast, Brazil 08, but he's not sure if he'd rather watch it with Lewis, and he'd ask, did you realise what was unfolding when you passed Glock, or Massa? You marvellous bloke, how did you cope and where did you find the strength to stand on the podium? Which, if you could watch back at Brazil 08 with one of the protagonists, would you watch it with Hamilton or Massa? Both of you.
I think I'd watch it with Hamilton because Massa's race was really straightforward, wasn't it? He just dominated. Lewis's got really, really complicated as the rain came down, didn't it? So, yeah I would probably choose Lewis.
And it would be less awkward at the end.
I guess, yeah.
What about you, Ed?
No, I'd agree with that purely for the same reason that Lewis's race was just a bit more eventful and a bit more interesting. There's more to talk about there. Although Felipe Massa's also, he's good company and an interesting character as well. So both of them. Let's get both of them in. That would be best.
Chris Hoffman picked the 2016 Indy 500 and with Alexander Rossi. If memory serves, I'm not an Indy person, but if memory serves, wasn't that a very, very delicate fuel mileage race? And then Rossi ended up.
It's actually, you can kind of see inside that one while you're watching it, because there's this great bit because it's Brian Herter who's calling it for Rossi, and there's this bit where he's sort of talking him round, and then I think it's on the back straight on the last lap when Herter realises the fuel's fine, and he basically says, right, go, because he knows Rossi's got enough fuel to get to the line, which is a really, really brilliant moment.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. Those ones when there's strategy involved and sort of things are changing, anything with changeable conditions is going to be interesting, especially if you can then interrogate the person with them. For example, Anssi Rilamo, I'm very sorry, I've butchered his name there, but at least I've used his real name, unlike Ed with some other people. He's ignored the rules completely. But for entertainment reasons, he would watch back the 2011 Canadian Grand Prix, but with Vettel. A lot of people picked that race and said Button, but he said with Vettel, which I think is just cruel. And for personal significance, Nürburgring 98 with Hakkinen. He's picked that, which is one that I've not heard before. So that's quite a good one. Chris Bloom, Monaco 2011 with Lewis Hamilton. Lewis is quite a popular one in these ones. Monaco, what happened in Monaco 11? Refresh my memory. Was that that wasn't the puncher one, was it? Was that the puncher one?
Might have been.
No, Monaco 11 was a chaotic one, wasn't it, for him? It was the one where he collided with Maldonado at the end, wasn't it? Yeah, it was, he collided with Pastor Maldonado at the at Sandevot while trying to come back through right at the end. That's an interesting one. That's a race that's kind of gone wrong for him.
Yeah. No, that's very interesting. Graham Walsh picked the 2009 Barcelona MotoGP round with Valentino Rossi to hear his views on the race. Can you remember what happened in that one, Ed?
No, I like and respect MotoGP, but I'm not quite as embedded in it, shall we say. So I can't I mean, it's Valentino Rossi MotoGP, so it's probably pretty mega in one way, shape or form, I imagine.
I'm going to put myself on a limb here and at risk of massive incompetence and mockery, which isn't surprising. I feel like that was a really crazy finish. Was that... No, that was a different year. I'm thinking of Rossi and Lorenzo. I think 09.
I think the important thing is that you've clearly prepared well for this segment.
Well, yeah, but shut up. So that's the way I think. No, I feel like... Barcelona. I'm pretty sure Barcelona was the...
Would you like me and Mark to fill time while you research?
I can tell you that Rossi won it. I'm just looking it up from Pedrosa.
This is live research. This is brilliant.
Yeah,
it was the Barcelona race was the Catalan Grand Prix. I forgot it's because MotoGP has about 17 Spanish rounds over the course of the season. But it was the race I was thinking of. It's that ridiculous finish between Rossi and Lorenzo. Rossi wins it by less than a tenth. So what's really annoying, and the reason I think I thought I knew it off the top of my head, is because I watched that race live. And that was mega. So that is an excellent, excellent pick. And I'm going to end on, and I haven't done this intentionally, it's just the way I accidentally arranged these in documents. I'm going to end on a nod to Sweden from Patrick Hansen, who he's not actually sure which race he'd watch back, but he wants to watch back a 1994 British Touring Car race with Rickard Rydell. Obviously, the 850 estate, which was, I can't remember if it was genuinely conceived as a joke, but it was a marketing ploy of Tom Walkinshaw's design, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it was also better in the wind tunnel than the saloon, apparently. So that was another reason.
And it was really good for them, you know, taking the shopping to and from the tracks.
Yeah.
So that was very, very popular. Yeah. I don't know if I'd like to watch a race back with Rickard in that car. I would love to relive the moment he's told what the car will be. That I think is more interesting, because I can't imagine it was Rickard and Jan Lammers, wasn't it, in 94?
Yeah.
I can't unless they were on board with it from the very beginning, I can't imagine a scenario in my head where they respond positively to that suggestion.
Yeah, it's particularly not if you're Rickard Rydell and you're someone switching out a single seaters because opportunities have dried up. And obviously Ricardo's a very accomplished single seat driver, one in Macau, of course. Have you got a question for future Scots people? Is this how this is supposed to work?
Well, that is how it was envisaged in the original. But I am still getting suggestions for this one. While it is a cop out and it is unoriginal, I'm going to do one more call to arms for this question, just because it's throwing up so many different series and drivers and eras and stuff like that. And it's just proving to be much more successful than I thought it would be when I asked it a couple of weeks ago. So I'm just going to have to continue and keep asking people to lob me a tweet with a race from history that they would like to watch back with someone, with presumably with the person in that race. In a lockdown situation, you can sit down, watch a race back with one person. Who would it be and why? So I'm sticking with that because it's throwing up so many interesting answers.
I think in that segment, we also learned why we shouldn't talk too much about MotoGP. So I will take this opportunity to suggest people subscribe to the Race MotoGP podcast, which is a much more knowledgeable two-wheeled podcast. It's one of our many podcast products. Well, we're going to have to move on now. Obviously, we'll be back with another podcast in the near future. Thanks very much, Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Please do head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen. We've been writing all sorts of stuff on there, including the piece we referenced of Mark's about what it'll take for drivers to get themselves kind of back in the zone and back ready for when racing does begin. And of course, there's loads of coverage of F1's financial situation, what's going to happen, as well as some interesting retro features on there. Check out our YouTube channel as well. If you search for The Race on YouTube, you will find us. Lots of interesting things cropping up on there as well. Thanks for joining us. So stay home, stay safe, and join us again on The Race F1 podcast.